I'm Kevin Flynn, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about Episode 9 of the team's latest series on The State versus Jason Carroll, which deals with the 1988 murder of Sharon Johnson of Bow, New Hampshire. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, this conversation may not make a whole lot of sense, so make sure you go back and do that before listening on. Our guests today include Jennifer Leahy. She's originally from Laconia, New Hampshire, and is a research assistant on this case. Currently, she is a photographer in the Bay Area, and that's the California Bay Area, not the New Hampshire Bay Area. Jennifer, thanks for coming on the Undisclosed Addendum.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're also joined, as always, by Robbie Ashadri, the lead investigator and one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast. Hello, Robbie.
Hey, Kevin. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to have a former Granite Stater also on the panel. Jennifer, can you tell us how you got involved in this case?
Sure. And I'll let Rabia chime in too. I had been following Undisclosed for years. And to make a long story short, I think it all started with a tweet, a question that Rabia put out there.
Yep.
About New Hampshire phone systems in the 80s or phone records in the 80s. And I like a good rabbit hole and looked into it a little bit. My mom used to work for the phone company many, many years ago. And so she likes a good search too. Long story short, yeah, we started talking and then I was gonna be in New Hampshire for a couple weeks in September. So we met up and then
I hired her. Yeah, that's what happened. Yeah. So you know, Kevin, you might remember this tweet. I think it was sometime over the summer, or I can't remember exactly when.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out, because I had these phone records that didn't show any, like, local calls, and I was baffled. You know, it's like Ken Johnson's 1988 phone records. So I just posted this question for anybody who might be from there, who might remember, who might have some leads, and Jennifer was one of many people who responded. But the thing about Jennifer is she's like, I'm going to figure this out. She just kept going, and then she contacted all the people she knows in New Hampshire, which is like everybody in her family and so many other resources. And then we were DMing. And that's when I realized she's got a real knack for this stuff, like not just an interest, but she's good at like digging up stuff. And so I said, you know what? And she offered, she's like, if there's anything else you want to find out, anything like it would be useful to have a local. I'm like, well, yes, I do, because I can only make a couple trips up there. And I know sometimes it's just, you'll just have better access if you walk into a library versus calling and emailing. So I was like, well, you know what? If you wanna work as my research assistant for this case, I would love to hire you. And that's how it happened. I don't know if Jennifer has a background in research. I literally never asked her.
I believe the question was, and I'd love to hear what the final answer was, it had to do about in-state long distance, about a phone call, because I do recall, and I think a lot of people remember this, sort of, you know, obviously if you called another state or another area code back in the old days, your phone bill would reflect that, and you'd get hit for, you know, how many, you know, cents a minute. But there were, I remember in New Hampshire, there were parts of the state, all one area code, but if you called far up north from far down south, you'd have to pay an in-state long-distance fee. And I think the question, Robbie, had to do with that and why it was important. Do you recall?
Yeah. So basically what I was trying to figure out was this. Look, if there is a conspiracy happening, which is what the state alleged, there had to be communications between Tony and Ken, right, to make this conspiracy begin. And from the records I had, I'm like, there's no phone calls between Manchester and Bow, which were the two places they lived. Now, the thing about Tony was he was transient. He was all over the place. I mean, even getting a hold of him would have been nearly impossible. But at least around the time of the murder, we know where he was staying and the phone number of that place. So I just wanted to know, listen, if somebody from Bow, from a landline, called Manchester, would it or would it not toll? Would it show up as billed on a phone record, or would it be within a local calling area so it wouldn't show? And that was like the first rabbit hole that I sent Jennifer on, and she spent a long time on it, only in hindsight to realize I had another set of cell phone records that would have given me the answer, or excuse me,
That
landline
cell phone.
records.
No, my goodness. Yes.
I'm back in the Ed Donside case. Another phone of records that I thought were identical because it was the same number and same dates, and turned out to
Right.
be di actually a different set. And I didn't realize that until later. So, but however, Jennifer got to go to the Telephone Museum of New Hampshire.
Not far from my home.
Yeah, Warner.
Yeah, the Telephone Museum.
And so, and Jennifer, you know, feel free to share the answer that you found, basically.
So what I came to understand is there were local calling areas, which I vaguely remember from growing up in the 80s. And so, and those would not show up on a customer's bill. They would be free calls. But then outside of those, there would be, yeah, in-state toll calls, basically. And then to sort of add another wrinkle, there were calls like certain geographical areas that were, I'm gonna probably not get all the details right here, but they were contiguous, you know, and this would be listed out. So you would have this information that if you were like contiguous with another area, that might also not be considered a toll call. But in either case, like a call from Bow to Manchester or vice versa would have been a toll call, an in-state toll call, and would have shown up on a customer's bill.
Yeah. Basically, we weren't able to find any phone calls between the Johnson home and where Tony was staying. However, there are a couple calls I think that are to a Manchester number that there's no indication they belong to Tony, but we're still trying to figure out if they could have. I mean, look, as far as I'm concerned, that whole story is suspect anyways. And if anybody made the phone call, it would have been Tony because Ken really would have had no way to get in touch with him at all. He had no idea where Tony was staying, so
Right, yeah. Yeah, maybe that number was to Bob. Who knows?
maybe, yeah.
So in episode 9, we go over Jason's trial and conviction, and then we look at the forensic evidence in the case, and I say that with tongue in cheek, which was most of which was never presented at trial. So Jason was tried twice. Can you tell us what happened at the first trial? Because a lot of what happened in the first trial came up in the second trial. You didn't really need to do it twice, but sort of bring us up to date on what happened in that first trial, how it finished, how that was important.
So at the first trial, you know, the jury found Jason not guilty of the charge of kidnapping, but guilty of the charge of conspiracy to commit murder. And then they deadlocked on the charge of first degree murder. At that point, the state could have been like, all right, well, we got him on the conspiracy charge. We're just going to go with that. But they're like, nope, we're going to try him again on the first degree murder charge. We're going to try to get to some conclusion there. So they took him to trial again on that one charge.
Do you recall what the conspiracy would have carried? Was it like 7.5 to 15? Was that?
Yeah, the conspiracy charge, I think it was 6 to 15 or something on that one. You know, parole and all that good stuff probably would have seen him out maybe in 5. And by the time he got to trial, he had already been in prison for a year and a half or so, you know, something like that. Or actually, no, lo I'm sorry, longer. I think 3 years. I can't remember. A little over 2 years, excuse me. So he'd been in prison a while. So that's what happened. So they went back to trial, and then that's the trial that we went over.
So, what was the evidence presented against Jason that got him convicted in the second trial? What really did it?
I don't know. What do you guys think did it? I put it in the episode. What do you think, Jennifer? What do you think? What do you think was like the strongest piece of evidence against him? I'm curious to know what you guys think.
I struggle to understand it.
Yeah. I get these texts from
I mean,
Jennifer that are constant, like, how, what, how, why, how? And I'm like, I don't know, Jennifer.
yeah, I really struggle. I mean, I've read through the articles and I'll go back and read them again. It's so frustrating. I don't
I mean,
I
the way.
mean, it seems like there was, like you said in the last episode, that there was a sort of desire for a conviction for some, you know, justice for this case, but how they ended up on him.
Robbie, was the jury aware that he had been previously convicted of the conspiracy?
I would only know if I had access to the voir dire, and I don't. I don't know what they voir dired the jury on, because we cannot get a hold of the defense files. Up until now, they seem to have disappeared, which is insane. But no, we don't really know. I mean, but what the jury definitely would have known is that Ken Johnson was not going to stand trial, and that Tony Puff had been acquitted. I mean, that I think it would have been impossible for a jury from New Hampshire to escape that news. So any jury going into this, I think it's interesting that they were deadlocked on the first at the first trial on this charge, but they agreed to conspiracy, meaning they think Jason had some involvement, but they weren't sure if he was the one doing the actual killing, I guess, or it didn't rise to first degree because it wasn't premeditated. Like I it's hard to know, but we know with Tony's trial, the jury just didn't believe the confessions. Here, it seems like in both trials, the jury kind of bought Jason's confessions. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember, wasn't there something about if they had been offered like the second degree murder the first time, like they just weren't happy with being forced into
Yeah, they weren't offered that. And I think the state
right.
recognized that. The state was like,
Yeah.
well, maybe next time around we'll give them
The
more options,
option.
more options.
No, literally, I think it says that in one of the news articles.
Yeah, and so they had more options. But look, I do think, and I set this up at the top of the episode, I think, is that what set Jason apart from Tony and maybe damned him further than Tony, the kind of trouble Tony was in, was the fact that Jason confessed to having the murder weapon. It's really the only physical piece of evidence the state can produce in this case. They've got nothing else, nothing, which is why they don't present a single forensic expert from their labs. They present nothing. Even on the knife, though, the crazy thing is they present no forensics around the knife, right?
Right. Yeah.
Now, most juries might not catch that. Most juries might not be like, that's a really weird oversight. That's a real big gaping hole. You're saying it's the knife. Well, how do you prove it's the knife? All they know is Dr. Fossum's testimony, which is like, suspect, I'd say at best.
Well, this is early 90s. This is still before OJ, right? Long before CSI. So the inclination for jurors to want to hear the science behind it was just not there at the time. So that might be why they overlooked, the big hole on that forensic evidence.
And the fact the state didn't put anybody from the crime lab or anybody who processed the cars, or any of the evidence, frankly, on the stand was because they knew it would hurt them. There was
Yeah.
nothing there that would help them at all. So the jury might not have known, but the prosecutors knew that there was just no there there when it came to forensics. And I would have loved if they had only put on the stand the guy who processed Ken's car, that would have opened the door for the defense to be like, can we talk about the knife found in Ken's car? But, at the same time, the defense could have talked about it during their case, and they didn't.
Again, this is, I mean, even today, not everybody buys the false confession phenomenon. Certainly at this time, we've talked about it already on the addendum. This was not a generation of jurors that, or investigators that thought people could be coerced to, voluntarily confess to things. Well, you can't be coerced to voluntarily do anything, but they would confess to a crime that they didn't commit. And I think the one thing that struck me about the difference between the first trial and the second trial was that I think it was Detective Scott who testified that when Lammy and Jason's mother left the room, that Jason, I guess, recanted, not recanted his confession. He said that, no, everything I said was true. I guess he's recanting the recantation, which might have been enough for the average juror to go, fake confession, not co oh well no that there he is, he's admitting that he's lying about not confessing, right? It sort of gets confusing, but I thought that one detail sort of gave a juror enough, well, I hate to say reasonable doubt because it's supposed to work the other way, but it certainly gave him an excuse to say, oh no, perhaps this confession is voluntary and it is true.
Right. And I think there's also the phenomena of which I mean, still exists today, but not to the same extent of just kind of believing the authorities that are testifying under oath before you.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you have people like Sergeant Scott, who's got a great record, and even Lammy, who, however he was in an interrogation room or with suspects, you know, he was known to be a charmer, right? Like, he really impressed people. He had a certain kind of influence when he walked into a room. People said, you notice Lammy. And I can imagine him sitting in front of a jury. He's testifying. They've gone over his credentials, how many cases, like how many homicides he's worked. This guy's a pro. They're going to give right. him, they're going to put whatever, they're going to prioritize his expertise over their own doubts, right, in a situation like that. So I think Lammy's testimony was pretty powerful for the state. I think the knife thing might have been what did it over the top. However, I do want to point out, you know, and this happens, we see this all the time, where witnesses will change their statements over time, either from the time they gave a statement to the police, or let's say there's been, in the meantime, depositions or hearings. By the time you get to trial, their statements change. And for some reason, the defense doesn't catch it. And that's what happened yeah. here. Yeah, with one of the witnesses who saw Sharon in the mall, 7:30 to 7:45. And they just didn't, they failed to point that out at the second trial. They did at the first trial, but not the second trial.
Yeah, I do want to talk about sort of the weakness in the defense's case in a minute. But Jennifer, one of the things that Rabia put in this episode that stood out to me was the idea of the term sandpit. Because it seems to go along with this pattern of Lammy coming in. We already know he doesn't like to sort of review what happened before he, you know, what has been turned up already. So it's that Lammy is in the mindset that Ken had a beard and that this happened in a place, you know, that looked like a sand pit, but it hadn't looked at that way at the time. I think there was something else, a thing that only Jason could have gotten by having it fed to him by somebody who didn't know, right? Or was already mistaken about a couple of those things. Did that stand out to you?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It didn't immediately stand out, but then I went back when I listened to the episode. It kind of caught me up short. I'm like, how did I missed that? Because I've read the articles, you know, the news reporting from the Union Leader and at least some from the Concord Monitor and the Globe. And last night I was actually looking back through, and at least the initial reporting, I mean, she's absolutely right. Like, there's no mention of a sand pit. I kind of want to dig into all the subsequent articles and see when and if it ever works its way into the reporting. But the initial ones don't mention it at all.
Yeah,
and they mention a construction site.
And certainly the police reports, none of them ever describe this place as a sandpit. It was just a weird thing to me, because when I had actually noticed it when I was first looking at the interrogation between Lammy and Carol, and Lammy kept pressing him about the sandpit. I'm like, what pit is he talking about? There was no pit there. And I don't know what things look like when he stepped into the case and later take Jason to the site. But it could be what Lammy was getting confused about was the fact that he had heard that Sharon and Ken would hook up at like different like pits, sand yeah. pits, right? Because that was something that we learned early on. But something Jennifer actually pointed out to me, because she sent me a couple of articles, was of like other murder victims found in sand pits.
There's a gravel pit.
Yeah, gravel pits or sand pits in New Hampshire. So, you know, people in New Hampshire, stay away from those sites.
Gee, yeah. A lot of site work getting done in the late 80s as we're building new housing.
I mean, Kathy Hansen was sexually attacked and raped in a pit like this. But
right. Yeah.
There was no pit there's just no pit at the construction site where Sharon was killed.
I think I'd like rationalized it in my mind just subconsciously thinking, you know, it was like maybe piles of dug up dirt from the pond excavation or gravel or whatever. But that's not. It's not the same, and that's not how it's described in the news.
Because I went to the law school of Dick Wolf, Law and Order, I certainly feel like I could give a closing statement in a murder trial, and I'm sure a lot of people were thinking about all the crazy stuff that you pointed out, all the ways of reasonable doubt, and you know, could make their own argument. Just looking at the jury with incredulity, like, can you believe all this stuff? I guess that didn't quite come across, or it wasn't nearly as effective as what the public defenders attempted. So, Robbie, tell me about some of the things that the defense did that maybe you might not have done or would have tried harder to do.
I mean, like I said, the state didn't put on any of the forensics. The defense kind of sort of did, but missed a lot of stuff. But well before the trial, you know, and I understand there is some strategy to being like, maybe we don't want all the evidence taken a look at real closely, just in case our client is guilty and something comes up, right? But I'll say this, that if I'm a defense attorney, and for some reason the state's not doing it, then I'm guessing there's nothing there. But I would have, I mean, the fact that they never raised, you know, the knife that's found in Ken's car to me is like egregious. A knife that would have easily made the wounds that Sharon suffered. And I'd love to talk about Jason's pocket knife too. But that was huge. Another witness they didn't put on the stand, which I thought was a weird choice, was Margaret O'Brien. They put on Kevin Doherty, who was the guy who had gone with, picked up his son from Chuck E. Cheese and then gone to the construction site to take a look at his lot that night. And that's a way to construct a timeline to be like, these people were there at this time. There was nothing happening then. There was no murder had taken place then. However, there's somebody who might have seen Sharon still alive after this time. And so the fact that Margaret O'Brien wasn't put on the stand, I thought was really weird. And a real big oversight, because I thought she's very credible as a witness. She gave some details that, you know, I haven't even, like, there's so much in this case that's hard to cram everything in, but I'll give you an example, and this is another oversight on the part of the state. One of the details she provided, she clearly described the shoes that the man was wearing, the couple that was on Auto Center Road. And there is no indication, because they didn't search his house, there's no indication the police ever looked to see if Ken owned a pair of shoes that looked just like the ones that O'Brien was describing. Her details are credible, that she's right on the timing. The report comes in not weeks and months or whatever after this happened, but literally days after the murder. She has little details, like she remembers what's on the radio, her windows. I mean, like, it's all just, you know, there's just no, it's all just too credible. And she, at the time she makes a report, has no idea what Ken Johnson looks like. None. But her description of him, which was not a really detailed description, but it certainly wouldn't rule him out. Like, he fits within that description. And so, and I also give weight to the fact that Ken was so interested in her statement. He didn't ask about anything else going on in the investigation. He's like, what is that woman saying? He really wanted to know. He was very concerned about what she was saying. And it, you know, his statements were all over the place, but he always made sure to put himself at home at 9:30. And that was suspicious to me.
Yeah. Look, this wouldn't be the addendum if Kevin Flynn didn't drop in some goofy detail about something in New Hampshire. So can I bring it?
Bring it.
Okay. So that Chuck E. Cheese is the place that I took Nancy Frechette for a date. And because I thought it would be cool, and nothing happened after that. So
what, you're like 8 years old?
No, I was I think I was a freshman in college.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I didn't know a lot about the city then, but I know a lot more now. Okay, so tell us about the strangulation marks, because this is also really interesting. What is the state's theory about the strangulation? And then what does the evidence show?
Well, look, the state's theory is based on Jason's confession that she was manually strangled, meaning Tony put his fingers around her neck and strangled her. There's no finger marks around her neck that are visible, but it doesn't mean, like, I have done enough research to know that you can strangle somebody like that and maybe not leave finger marks, but that wouldn't account for the marks that do exist, which are these smooth lateral marks on both sides of her neck that look like either a ligature, which is exactly a ligature, meaning a rope or something like that, that Dr. Fossum first put in his autopsy. His initial impression was a ligature. That evolved over time because Look, I'm not saying that he changed his statement to match, the state's case. However, at some point, the state was like, well, we can't say it was a rope because there was no rope there and the rope doesn't show up in any. But however, she did have a shirt that disappeared. So maybe it was a shirt. And honestly, it could have been a shirt. It easily could have been her shirt. So the point is that the marks that appear could not be finger marks, and which mean that she was strangled with something else. And if that was the case, then that doesn't show up in Jason's statement. It doesn't show up, and it's not part of the state's case. So that's the significance of that. But also, the fact that Fossum changed his statements over time is just really problematic.
Jennifer, were you like me when you heard about that you thought it was perhaps the shirt or the bra or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, the shirt crossed my mind for sure. And I also what struck me hearing some of the autopsy details was she had like blows to the head, right? She was hit on the head, and I don't remember hearing that in any of Jason's
No, there's no, no, yeah, she
state.
had,
Like that part doesn't enter in, right?
no, he never mentions that. If I was a prosecutor, I would, however, make the argument that, look, in the heat of a struggle like that, people are getting hit and all kinds of things are happening and you're trying to control her. I think there's a way to overlook that, but certainly there's no indication that Sharon was like dragged and then left to the side. None of that seems to happen. In fact, the way Jason describes it in one of his statements is that she's already down kind of by the pond. She's like by the edge of the open space by the clearing, and that's where she's attacked. Not that she's attacked like in the center and then dragged to the side. Something else I did not mention in any of the episodes is that one of the original Guy Kimball, one of the original investigators, actually his theory was that he thought she might have been killed somewhere else, then brought to the site in a vehicle, her body pulled out and then dragged to where it was left.
It would account for the drag marks for certain, yeah.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, okay, when I'm thinking through it, everything is consistent with her having been killed there, including the big
Right.
pools of blood. Everything's consistent with that. Like, if she was killed somewhere else, I mean, like, are you telling me then that person took the body out of the car, took off her rings and all that other stuff and left it? Like, it. And also, if I'm driving a car up to dump a body, I'm gonna pull up to where I want to leave it and take it out, right?
Right.
I'm not gonna like be like, okay, I'm gonna pull her out here and then drag her 30, 40 feet. I don't think that's credible, but I could be wrong. I mean, but there's that possibility. I think it's a vague possibility.
There were two knives that came into the frame here for this episode. Jennifer, I want to ask you a question. If you were hired to commit a murder and you were going there to do it, would you bring with you as the weapon a pocket knife?
Absolutely not. No.
Even if it had like the Boy Scout, like the can opener on one end.
No, I
Oh.
had a Swiss Army knife growing up. No, absolutely not. Like I worked for a wilderness program for a few years and like folding knives that don't lock are
Oh, yeah.
they're dangerous
Absolutely. But
for
also
that
think,
sort of action, right?
sure, right. Because think about that before we get into the 4-inch wounds and the 2-inch blade or whatever. If the blade doesn't lock, it means that if you put enough pressure on it, it will fold back on your fingers. And also, if there's that much blood, that knife gets very wet and slippery. And if there's no hilt, your hand moves around. The perpetrator very likely injured himself in some manner with a knife. Certainly, if you're using a pocket knife, you couldn't stab that many times that deep and not have that blade fold up on one of those stabs, right?
That's exactly what I thought too. I was like, there's no way. And then also, there's so many grooves in a folding knife. Like, even if you'd run it through the wash, supposedly, I can't imagine that you would get every.
Well, sometimes I guess it's better to not test it because then you can't not exclude it, right? What was your thoughts, Robbie, about that? Because certainly the depth of the wounds in some cases seemed to be, you know, twice as deep as the length of the blade.
Yeah, you'd literally have to plunge that little pocket knife in, handle and all, to get 4 inches deep, especially in the wound in the back. And again, you know, what's really troubling to me about this is that literally a year before the trial, Fossum testified on deposition that it would take a minimum 4-inch blade to make these kinds of wounds. Yeah. I mean, it's just such a lack of integrity, right? Like, to make this huge jump to, and we know the investigators were still looking for other knives. They were asking other people, hey, you got a knife, you know, you got a knife, anybody else find a knife? And they had their doubts too, but at the end of the day, it's crazy, just decided to go with it. I mean, they decided to go with it because all they really have was a confession, and they couldn't afford to undermine the confession. They would have had an easier conviction with Ken's knife in many ways, if they said this was the murder weapon, but then that wouldn't have fit into the story. And the crazy thing is, Lammy probably Lammy had no idea about Ken's knife because he didn't read the initial reports. So if he had known, then I'm guessing that Jason's confession would have included that knife and not the knife that he went with.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, Jennifer, we first hear this described as a utility knife, which could mean a lot of different things. But when you hear that it was a kitchen knife that he had in his car, again, do you have a kitchen knife that you're just driving around in your car with because you might need it for something? Even if you go to a restaurant, you don't bring your own kitchen knife, right?
No, exactly.
And it's wiped.
It's been wiped. I think that's one of the most telling things of, you know, it's not just what you find, it's what you don't find, right? Like Sharon's car's been wiped. Nothing else been wiped but that knife. It's almost like it just magically appeared in that car without anybody having to, it like levitated to the car.
You had a really interesting interview with Lisa where you talk about the car and, you know, being able to get into it and whether or not he would have that kind of knife for any of his construction work or handiwork. So good job on getting that. But remind us what she said. That wasn't, a kitchen knife wasn't something.
She was like, and you know, the funny thing is we had talked a long time before we got to that point. At that point, she was asking me questions. She was like, what did they get Jason on? What evidence do they have against Tony and Jason? Like, she was asking questions about, and I was explaining, and then I was like, you know, the odd thing is in Ken's car, they found this, his wedding band off, which is also really weird, and which was never examined for blood or anything. Right. And this knife. And she was like, wait, what? And she's like, I broke into his car all the time. I was in his car all the time stealing money or coins or cigarettes. And, you know, kids do that kind of stuff. And he never carried a knife. Like, there was never such a thing in his car. And I can understand that. I mean, I remember going through my dad's car sometimes, you know, not looking for stuff, but just, I just knew what my dad had in his car. And it would have been really odd to find a knife in my dad's car. But if it was a knife that that could have possibly been used for construction, it would have been easier to understand. And, you know, when it said utility knife.
Yeah. Used for construction.
I don't know.
In that case, like, I could understand removing your wedding ring because in some cases, when you're working with machinery, it actually can be very dangerous to your finger. And a lot of workmen do that. Usually they put it right back on. However, go ahead.
However, that would only make sense if Ken was actually working.
There you go.
No evidence that Ken had been working for months.
There you go. But I would believe that he took his ring off for some legitimate reason more than he had a kitchen knife in his car for some legitimate reason.
A clean kitchen knife.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, I've opened so many Amazon packages with a kitchen knife. I don't think I have any clean kitchen knives in my house.
It can't even be clean if you've washed it and put it away. It's still going to have your fingerprints on it unless you're washing it with gloves.
Oh, oy vey. Okay, listen, you also had another really good piece of evidence because if there is a conspiracy for money, that money comes from someplace and goes to somebody else. And you talk an awful lot about the bank records for Ken. First of all, it's crazy that the month of the murder, that those records are not available. But you have everything before and everything after. Tell us what you found.
Well, what we have is actually what's after, not before.
Nothing before. Okay, so what's after, right? And not that month, though, all right? I'm right about that.
You're right about that. Nothing for July.
Okay.
And that is absolutely deliberate. I mean, we see this over and over again in cases where the prosecution's like, this doesn't make us look good, so we're just gonna not include it. But this is an oversight, again, on the defense's part. They should independently be subpoenaing those records. They should be prepared with these documents that the state's not providing or doesn't have.
If only somebody had said that to the state of Maryland, Mr. Brady would, you know, not have been so famous. But okay, I digress. Go ahead.
But it's like the missing incoming phone records from a non-self. It's like that kind of thing, right? Like, it's not an accident. It's a decision. And so, so we have no idea. Because if we had seen the records, I can virtually guarantee it would have been just like we saw in August, September, October, which was like a balance of, I'm not kidding, $99 was his average balance up until he got that $50,000 disbursement. And the thing is that it's very possible that Sharon had no idea how much money was in the account. She handed him every paycheck. He paid the mortgage. He paid the bills. So many people told the police the same thing, that he handled all the finances, which is crazy to me because she knew he had a gambling problem. But she still, I don't know. I mean, like, you know, she still allowed him to do that. But, you know, that's coercive control and abuse, and that's how it works.
Right, right, right. So, I mean, you added up a lot of what those payments were, seemingly legitimate ones to banks and things like that. I don't know. You probably didn't get all the way to 50,000, but was there 10,000 that you couldn't get to?
We pretty much got to. I mean, like he was only down to a couple of grand at the end of the 3 weeks later after he got the 50K. Look, he made a $4,100 payment for the mortgage. That cannot be a 1 month payment. Like, right? I mean, like in 88, I don't know what the house was worth. Probably in the $130,000, $150,000 range. I know they took a second mortgage of 40K.
If that. Yeah, it wouldn't. Yeah. A lot of houses then were going $78,000, $80,000. What, you know?
Right.
Oh, yeah. Back in that day, sure.
Yeah. And so clearly those were, he had not paid the mortgage in a while, is what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. And then all the other payments, many of the other payments to his, I'm like, he paid his attorney. So I'm assuming he hadn't been able to pay the attorney until then. He paid for his back surgery, what was owed, I guess, part of what was owed. He paid like four other banks. And I don't know what those banks were being paid for, what the loans were, and the state never bothers to subpoena the records to find out what are these payments for, who took the loans. Like, I do have a feeling that those might have been tied to the P.O. box, though. They could have been loans that he took without Sharon knowing.
Jennifer, if your buddy had to borrow $5 or $10 from you to go to Weir's Beach, would you assume that that buddy also had $10,000 sitting around in a shoebox at home or something, still needed to borrow a couple of bucks from you?
No, I don't think that would be my first assumption.
No. But he's a brilliant conspiratorial mastermind with his pocket knife and his vanishing cash. So also, Jennifer, Robbie's done a great job of making this what the authors would call a closed mystery. As opposed to a lot of open mysteries, where we sort of see what's going on right away with our suspect. She's holding back just enough to tantalize us each week. And one of the things that, you know, all this time I'm thinking is that, well, we'll get to find out what's in the defense files. Because this must have really informed a lot of the investigation and a lot of Robbie's investigation and writing. So, was your reaction like mine, which was WTF with these files?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The first time I heard that, I just, there's a few things I struggle to let go with. And I probably ask Robbie way too many questions about, but it just drives me bananas. Like the fact that they don't have access to them.
Next time you're in New Hampshire, Jennifer, I'm hoping maybe you can befriend Mr. Maynard and say, hey, can I just take a look in your garage, maybe?
Oh, you just say the word and I'm there. Like, literally, I would love nothing more.
I have said the word, my friend. I have said the word.
Okay. Yeah. That thought has crossed my mind so much. That and, like, why they never searched Ken's house. I, like, can't. It's really hard to let a few things go.
Yeah. Listen, I'm putting this out there as a public call. If there's anybody who is related to Mr. Maynard, mm-hmm. who, and I believe his daughter's an attorney, too, is what I've understood, who can maybe just say, hey, can we just take a look? Because sometimes, honestly, he might have, I don't even know what his, how he is. You know, he's an elderly person. He might just not remember things. It could be a lot of things happening here. It could literally be in a box in a basement or an attic or a garage or something, and he has no idea. So if there's anybody,
interspersed in other boxes of other things that he'd been looking
who
at, but
knows? Yeah, who knows?
yeah.
But there's no way for it to completely disappear unless they were deliberately destroyed. It would have been boxes and boxes of files. So, and if he deliberately destroyed them and doesn't want to tell us, I mean, that's a long shot, but I doubt it is, I guess, what I'm thinking about it.
Well, you'd serve yourself a lot of effort if you knew that, right? If they had been destroyed, you could say, fine, it's a hole, we'll move on. But to have to, spend time chasing phantom files all over New England is probably not a great use of your time.
The truth is, like, the defense files might have something that shed more light on that, look, this, we have discovery files that are missing, the entire chunks of them. So maybe the defense files contain them and help us fill in more gaps. Defense files will not have Brady because by the fact that it's been turned over means it's not Brady. But the defense files could have stuff that could prove ineffective assistance of counsel.
Right.
Like they had evidence that they didn't present at trial. And so you just never know how it could be helpful, right? So it's and so I'm still holding out hope. Even though our series is coming to an end, it doesn't mean the work on the case is anywhere close to the end.
Can I ask one question that didn't come up? Where is that pocket knife today? Does anybody know?
Theoretically, it should be with all the evidence in this case
Oh,
in an
jeez.
evidence locker somewhere in New Hampshire. We're trying to figure that out.
Oh, man. So you end on a really great cliffhanger, which is, although everybody thought he was dead, like Ken Johnson, like Tony Puff, Roland Lammy is alive and well and answering your telephone call. So,
I'm embarrassed to admit that I might have been the only one to think he was dead, because I'm the
no. We've heard this, and I've heard from other people that just assumed, because I hadn't heard from him, that he was dead. Now the wait staff at the Red Blazer on Manchester Street in Concord know that he's alive because he keeps coming in every Tuesday night or whatever the hell it was, right? And we should have gone there first, but no, that was not a wrong assumption. I just, again, based on his age and that he wasn't in the news anymore, I also thought that, well, he must be dead by now.
And it could have been a complete misunderstanding on my part. I think what happened was when I was discussing this case very early on with Jason's attorney, Cynthia, she mentioned the names of a number of officers who were dead, and either she included Lammy by mistake or I literally just made that up in my head, and I easily could have. But I will tell you, I spent 6 to 8 months investigating without even attempting to find Lammy, because I'm like, unfortunately, Lammy's dead. And so when Sarah Kalen went to talk to Thomas Sexton, and Sarah's the investigator we've had on a couple of times, who worked with me, she's been on the addendum. She's the one who I would always send to law enforcement because, she's former law enforcement. And she's like, yeah, Leo Morenci's dead and this person's dead. And he's like, well, wait a minute, Lammy is not dead. He's like, I would know if Lammy's dead. And then I got a phone call from Sergeant Lammy.
Yeah. Certainly, if Lammy heard that Sexton heard that somebody thought he was dead, he probably definitely wanted to set the record straight.
He was, yeah,
So.
he was a little irritated with that, that we thought he was dead.
Well, there are other things that he probably should be worried about after talking to Robbie Ashadri. So I'm not going to ask any more about what comes from that conversation because it is our season finale. But I am so looking forward to it. Because, again, I just say that you guys always do a great job, certainly in the research. I think, as you've done this season, I think the writing has been superior. We see this all the time on social media. It's the best GD season of Undisclosed. So I'm just so glad that you were able to do it and that I got to be a little part of it. Can we go to social media? Answer a couple questions.
Let's do it.
Shannon asks, why did the judge insist they find a verdict when they were deadlocked? that isn't necessarily uncommon that a jury comes back and they say we can't agree, that a judge would send them back.
No, it's not uncommon. It does. Okay. If the judge said, basically, we're not going to, like, this is not going to end until and unless you reach a verdict, then you've got a problem. That's a legal issue. I mean, that's, you know, that's not, there's some rule, and only Colin Miller would know it off the top of his head, but judges can't do that. He can't force you to come to a verdict. What he can do is encourage you to try again. And I'm guessing in this case, first of all, this is the second trial. It's been dragged out for, you know, Sharon's been, you know, deceased for 4 years now. And maybe the judge was like, are they going to make us do this a third time? Like, you know, because the state might do this, try him a third time. And so that might have been the thinking there. He was in his right to do it because of the way he did it. You know, he didn't insist that they come to a verdict. He just said, why don't you spend a little more time on this?
Chris asks, you had the jury reasons for Tony's acquittal. Do you not have the jury reasons for the guilty verdict? And Jason, is it because you don't have the defense file?
That's pretty much it. I mean, it could be that, you know, not all parties do a post, you know, a verdict, whatever, interview of jurors. It doesn't always happen. It just so happened that Tony's attorneys did. So we don't even know if Jason's attorneys did that or not, frankly.
The identities of the jurors, were they documented someplace, a document that has survived?
The names of the jurors?
Yeah.
In those defense files. I mean, I've reached out. Yeah, I've tried with Mr. Maynard. I reached out to Eric Wilson, who stepped in to assist Mr. Maynard. No response. And it's kind of weird because normally what will happen in these cases is the prosecutors don't want to talk to you, but defense counsel will want to talk to you. And this time around, they didn't want to.
Right. Right. John says that, you know, it's so sad that so many witnesses and investigators from Sharon's murder are now deceased, including the prime suspect, I think maybe we should talk a little more about. What does that mean for Jason's chances of getting his case overturned, not having those folks around?
Well, look, one of the hopes that we had, and this has been one of the bigger challenges for me investigating this case, is that you want to look for ways to get a defendant into court, right, to get them another chance. Jason has never had a post-conviction proceeding before, so he has a right to request the DNA be tested for any physical evidence that exists. But what we're always hoping when we pick up one of these cases is that we can find some actual new evidence, you know, something that nobody's discovered before. Maybe it's Brady, maybe it's not. But that kind of can exist in this case because of the fact that evidence would either come from DNA testing, new evidence, you know, suddenly, you know, some kind of forensic test, or somebody tells us something. And the people who are close, not only is Ken dead and Tony dead, the people closest to Ken who might have had some information, a number of them also are deceased. Ken had sisters who stood by him steadfastly and believed he was innocent the entire time. His brother Tom is deceased. And if anybody would have known anything, it probably would have been Tom. So, yeah, as far as Jason's chance of getting his case overturned, it doesn't mean it's not possible. Again, we don't know what we could find in defense files. But that the fact that nothing has ever actually been forensically tested. Imagine that both the pocket knife and Ken's knife are in an evidence locker somewhere. And we can get that DNA tested, you know, or that her bra or her clothing is. Any of those things, you know, they should not have been returned, would not have been. God, I hope the knife wasn't returned to Ken. I know the car was. I would just fall out of my chair if the knife was. But yeah, so the new evidence would really, it's all about getting new evidence or finding some real egregious ineffective assistance or Brady. And so the fact that they're dead doesn't help, but it doesn't kill it. It doesn't kill the chances at all.
Lorraine posts something. She ends it with, thanks, Rabia, and Undisclosed. I love the work that you all do. I know Jennifer agrees with me that that's a sentiment we can back up. Lorraine asks, how do you drop charges against the person who initiated the crime and not against those who were hired? I think Colin mentioned this, that you don't have to convict all the other members of a conspiracy to convict one of them. So is that kind of where that this happened?
Yeah, I think this is, you know, it's all statutory. So it depends on the way the state statutes are written in terms of who can be convicted for what. And in this case, the state was well within its rights to pursue charges against Jason and not against Ken. Legally, they could do that. It's the ethics of it suck, and you know, the optics of it are shady, and it just seems really unconscionable, but it doesn't mean it's not legal.
Jennifer, I want to ask you, now that you know that Ken Johnson has passed away, do you think that if we can prove that Jason Carroll did not have anything to do with it, with Ken gone, that Sharon Johnson's family could have some kind of justice without Ken? It's not a legal question. It's just sort of a moral question, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel for them. I know that a number of her family members passed away, I think, within, you know, several years after her death. I can't imagine what they have gone through. And I don't know what that would.
It seems to me, Jennifer, the only justice that we can get in this case is to get Jason out of jail. That there's nothing we can do about Ken Johnson now.
No, I mean, maybe there's a way to have the truth come out. You know, I mean, I hold out hope that, that somehow there's still a way to find out at least a little, you know, what happened. But yes, I mean, for Jason, like, yeah.
I mean, we keep talking about how the state kept coming back and that there was an acquittal for Tony. They won't be able to do anything for Ken. They had to go to a second trial. There's just a lot of pressure within the system to hold somebody accountable that fuels a lot of emotion and whatnot. We are separated far enough, long enough, that emotion should really not be there, and we can look at it with sober eyes. And that means, look, you know, all this stuff about Ken, that was really incriminating. And, you know, even if you believe this crazy conspiracy story, there's got to be a way to, you know, hold Ken responsible. I don't know if there is, but it just seems like if we could look at it, I could say if the man could look at it again without this assumption that, you know, the guy in jail has to be the guy that did it, that we might be able to pull this apart and really, you know, provide a true sense of justice.
I hope so.
You know, one of the hard things about the work, post-conviction work and the work we do at Undisclosed, is the fact that there is this expectation from people all the time to say, and it's almost like there's a little bit of anger behind it. Okay, yeah, you're trying to free this guy, but then who's going to pay for who killed this victim? It happens in like every case. And there's almost this expectation that we are also responsible for not just trying to exonerate somebody, which is really the only thing we're trying to do here, but also that it's our responsibility to then arrest, prosecute, and convict somebody else, where right. We don't have the state powers to do it. I can't subpoena people. Like, I can't do the kinds of things that the police can do. A district attorney can reopen a case and decide to start the investigation over again. We can't do that. And it's also not, it's only the state's responsibility to do that. And if they fail it, then that's who you hold accountable, not people who are doing innocence work.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Because if someone is wrongfully imprisoned, whose fault is that? The police, the prosecutor, the people on that side. So don't be angry with the defense or an innocence project investigator. The fault lies with the system if somebody has their conviction overturned for whatever reason, really. It's their fault. Don't be mad at the people who are coming in to advocate for justice for these folks. That's just my opinion. Okay, we had a really great discussion here today because it was a really great episode 9. So this was wonderful. Rabia, as far as a sneak peek for the season finale, we know you're going to be talking to Sergeant Lammy. Are we also going to maybe get a hint at what the legal process is going forward for Jason?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of talked about, you know, what we are hoping for next and what's possible next today. But I'm in the middle of drafting the finale, and it's so hard to decide. Like, there's so many of these like little its and bits of information that kind of didn't make it into this episode or that episode. You also want to let people know, but then it's like, do I turn this last episode into a bullet point of things I also want to talk about? You know, it's I'm struggling a little bit to how do you wrap up what's there. But We're gonna circle back to Ken in this episode before we get to Sergeant Lammy. And I'm also gonna drop a little surprise for our listeners who don't know that there might be a whole nother crew covering this case later, maybe early next year. And I'm gonna talk about that. And I'm excited to share that news because we want as many eyes as we can get on this case.
Absolutely. So Jennifer Leahy, thanks for the work that you did researching this for Rabia and also for joining us today on the Undisclosed Addendum.
Thank you, Kevin.
And Rabia Chaudhry, one more episode to go.
One more to go. Thank you for bearing with me, Kevin. And Jennifer, thank you for so much help. I mean, I can't, there's so many things that Jennifer, and she's still looking for them, even though I'm like, well, I kind of can't get in the series anymore. And she's like, whatever. She's been an amazing researcher, and I'd love to work with her in the future.
Oh, I would love that too. Thank you.
If you have questions about this case or any of the other cases covered on Undisclosed, you can ask them on social media. Just look for Undisclosed Pod on all the socials. Thank you so much to executive producer Methil Talhan and to Colin, Rabia, and Susan for continuing to let me be part of their work. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. More to come next week.